Thank you. Thank you very much.
Doctor, where is that glass of water I was promised? I got it. Oh, I got to take the stopper out first. That's all right. Now we poke that back.
Well, it's a pleasure, I'll tell you, to be with you today. Mr. President, Governor Williams, all these distinguished guests, I want to talk to you a little bit today about the President and the Presidency of the United States and what it means to me. And I hope it'll make some impression on you young men and young women who are now taking what they call a commencement, which means that the country is going to be under your direction from now on. I've tried to do my part for the last 40 years. It'd be kind of hard for me to start over again at 76, and I don't intend to try. But I want to say to you that I was informed by the president of this university that it is the first land-grant college. Well, I had an experience one time after an election in Washington, after I became president, when the Congress turned to the other political party. And we had a graduate of Oxford University, I can't say it like they do, who was very much interested in government. And he made the statement that it would be a good thing if the then-present occupant of the White House would appoint a good Republican to be Secretary of State and then resign. At that time, the Secretary of State succeeded. He doesn't anymore because I changed that. Well, I was at a dinner a few nights after that, and I informed the gentleman that I was very highly pleased that a Rhodes Scholar and a graduate of Oxford University would give me such good advice. But I sincerely wish that he'd gone to a land-grant college and he'd know better than to do that. Well, now, generally speaking, my friends, we most of us have a better idea of the presidency of this country and what it means. And of the courts and the Congress, we have a better idea. Their words and acts are preserved in official publications and on official records. But there's no single publication that preserves the utterances and the acts of the presidency, and many of them can be found only inadequately reported, and I say inadequately reported, in the newspaper files. The personal papers of the president, which are the best record of the functioning of the office, have often been scattered or destroyed. And I'm trying to correct that condition by encouraging an official and current publication of all the utterances of the president, just as the Congressional Record reports all the public utterances of the Congress, by establishing firmly the precedent set by President Franklin D. Roosevelt that the papers of the president should be preserved as the property of the nation. You know, George Washington set a precedent. He took all his papers home with him, and ever since that, every president has owned his own papers, unless he wants to put them in the Library of Congress or in some university or school to have them taken care of. And usually they're piled away and covered with dust before you can find out anything about them. I'm trying to have that remedy. The records of presidents, their presidential papers, have been scattered from one end of the country to the other. And I can give you a shining example of how that happens. Thomas Jefferson had the most orderly set of papers of any president of the United States. His grandnephew and grandniece got hard up. You know, Jefferson died a poor man. And they tried to sell those papers to the Congress, the government of the United States. The Congress made the study of them and said they couldn't take only official papers. I want to say to you that every paper a president touches is an official paper, even if it's only a letter cussing out a music critic. Well, the Congress finally paid some money for about half of those Jefferson papers, and the rest of them were scattered. And Princeton University is spending $250,000 to get those papers together. And they're putting them in volumes, and I suppose your university is getting them as they're published. There'll be 58 volumes of it. I have the 14 volumes now in the library down home, and the first volume that came off, bound in Morocco, and they gave one to me and one to General Marshall for the simple reason that we worked so hard to get the job done. And I sincerely hope that one of these days we'll have that sort of a job done for every set of presidential papers now in existence. When I went down to the Congress to get an authorization for the microfilming and the indexing of the 16 part sets of the presidential papers in the Library of Congress, do you know that the leaders of the Congress didn't know they were there? Some bird went in there the other day to look up something. Well, it was while I was still in the White House. It wasn't the other day. And he took a look at things, and they let him in so he could find what he wanted. And the next thing they heard of him, he'd taken one of the documents out of one set of those presidential papers and taken it down on the street and sold it for $300. So you see, they're rather valuable. And I've got 4.5 or 5 million documents down there. So come down and help yourself if you can get in. To this end has been built in Independence, Missouri, what's known as a library. It's an archives building for the storage of those papers, and I hope eventually for the storage of a microfilm set of every set of presidential papers that's ever been in existence. And I want to say to the president of this university that I'm the 32nd man that's been a president of the United States. General Eisenhower is the 33rd man who's been president of the United States, and the only reason the Hearst paper started out calling me the 33rd, they counted Cleveland twice. And if they're going to count every man who had two terms twice, they'll have to make me number 41. On the dedication of that institution, on the 6th day of July, 1957, the building and its contents were turned over to the federal government for operation by the National Archives of the United States Government. And about $21 million worth of documents and about $250,000 or $300,000 worth of presents which the heads of states gave to me as President of the United States. I didn't think I'd received those presents if I'd have stayed down in Missouri on the farm, so I thought they ought to belong to the people of the United States. They didn't give them to me as an individual. They gave them to me as President of the United States, and they belong to you now. And as I said a while ago, try and get them. When all the papers in the Library of Congress and all those that are in colleges and universities have been sorted and indexed, I hope that some of you will come down to this institution that's in Independence, Missouri, and take a look at what is there and give me a hand to help get the job done the way it should be done. Now, Sam Rayburn's got a library down in Texas that covers the whole of the history of the legislative branch of the government. He has all the records of the Congress of the United States from the First Continental Congress down to date, and certified copies of every bill that's ever become a law under the Constitution of the United States. And the Chief Justice of the United States, who acted as the dedicating officer of that institution down at Independence, has been persuaded to have the Congress to authorize the appropriation of the $300,000 that Mr. Justice Holmes left to the government. I don't know why he did. I guess he was mad at his kinfolks. Anyway, that's where it went. And they're going to try to write definitive biographies of all the justices of the High Court. Now, there are very few people that know what the right title of the Chief Justice is. He's not Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at all. He's Chief Justice of the United States. And you can ask any set of youngsters, and there won't be one or two, maybe none, that can tell you exactly what his title is. And I bet there aren't four young men in that list up there, unless they made a special study of it, can name four chief justices, and there've only been 14. So it's a good thing to study the history of the United States and find out who made it and how he did it. The first three articles of the Constitution outline the three branches of the government of this great republic. Article 1 sets up the legislative branch of our government and gives that branch certain powers and duties. And among those powers and duties is the control of the purse strings of the government. That's the reason the Speaker of the House is the second most powerful man in the government. Because unless he says so, you can't get money enough to run any institution, because the appropriations have to originate. They don't have to, but they do originate in the House of Representatives. and all bills for taxes have to originate in the House of Representatives. So it's a good thing to be a good friend of the chief of the Speaker of the House of Representatives if you need any money to run this institution. Article 2 sets up the executive branch of the government and gives the executive certain powers and duties, which I shall enumerate a little later. Article 3 sets up the courts, creates the Chief Justice of the United States, and gives certain powers and duties to those courts. The founding fathers, and I hate to hear them called fathers, for there are hardly any of them that are beyond 45 years of age, and I think only two more than 50. One of them was George Washington, the other one was Ben Franklin. Now, Article 2 of the Constitution, but they left a good many details vague. That sets up the presidency and how it works. And if you want to know how it works, read Article 2 of the Constitution and then listen to what I have to tell you, because some of the things I'm going to tell you are not in the Constitution. The office of the chief executive has grown with the progress of our republic. It has given our nation a means of meeting our greatest emergencies. And today it is one of the most important factors in determining whether we provide leadership for the free world, leadership for the Western Hemisphere, and leadership for the people of these United States. Now, if you take the powers of the president as enumerated in Article 2 of the Constitution, and the duties that have been given to the president by the growth and development of our institutions, and add them up, you will conclude that the president has the most difficult job in history. It's also the most honorable and powerful office in the history of the world, and one of which every American should be proud, because the president is given his position by the voice of the people. And no emperor, king, or dictator in history ever rose to a position of such power and influence as this chosen spokesman of a free government and a free electorate. The president's job's really six jobs. You must bear one thing in mind. As a former president of the United States, my sympathies are with the man who has to hold down these six jobs. I may not agree with him politically, and I reserve the right to say whether you think he's doing his work well or badly, but he still has my sympathy because I know exactly what he's up against, and I sincerely hope that every single one of you will pray for his safe return from this Eastern trip. If he thinks it's necessary, it must be. One of the first of these presidential jobs, and this one is enumerated in Article 2 of the Constitution, is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. This is vitally important to the citizens of this great United States. He must see that the laws are properly enforced. The Constitution says executed. I guess they mean the same thing. The next job of the president, and this is also enumerated in the Constitution, is to be Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces. He appoints and commissions officers in the Army, Navy, and Air Force. He has complete authority over the armed forces of the United States. He can place generals and admirals in command, and when it's necessary, he can take them out, too. And sometimes that is necessary. It's a very great responsibility, and one that has to be considered very, very carefully. Every president who was a war president had troubles with his generals. Madison had his troubles, and so did James K. Polk with old Fuss and Feathers, who was Winfield Scott and commanding general down in Mexico and the finest looking general the country ever had. And he wanted to run for president so bad he didn't know what to do, but he didn't get to do it. Then along came Abraham Lincoln and James K. Polk. James K. Polk was the man who bought the southwestern half of part of the United States, almost as many square miles as the Louisiana Purchase, but it wasn't quite as good as the Louisiana Purchase because it didn't contain Missouri. If you remember, Lincoln had his troubles with generals, plenty of them. He had to fire four or five before he finally got one that helped him to win the war. He had to fire McClellan, and McClellan finally ran for president against him. And then he had to fire old Pope, who was the successor to the old man who lost the Battle of Fredericksburg, Virginia. Old man Burnside, the name of the Whiskers. At any rate, when Pope was appointed to be the commanding general of the Army of the Potomac, he was a kind of a publicity hound, and he made some broad statements. He said that he was going to command the army in the field, and that his headquarters would be in the saddle. When he lost the second battle of Bull Run, old Horace Greeley made the statement that he evidently had his headquarters in the saddle and he must have sat on his brains. Now, the third job I would like to enumerate to you and talk to you about is the president's role in foreign affairs. He's the foreign policy maker of the country. The Constitution says that he shall appoint ambassadors with the advice and consent of the Senate and receive ambassadors and ministers from foreign governments. Few of us fully appreciate what that means. Our ambassadors are the personal agents of the President of the United States. They are his eyes and ears abroad. The ambassadors of other countries cannot operate here unless they are approved by the President. To put it another way, the President recognizes foreign countries diplomatically, and this is a great power and a very great responsibility. The President is our foreign policy maker also, because he negotiates treaties. The Constitution says he shall have power to make treaties by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. In the days when the Constitution was young, George Washington tried to carry out this provision by going personally to the Senate with a proposed treaty to get their advice and consent during his negotiations. The senators said they couldn't act on things that way. They said they would have to appoint a committee and have it report back, and they couldn't work properly with the president sitting in the Senate. At this, George got indignant and left in a huff, and he made some very, very salty remarks, which I can't repeat here. So ever since, the president has negotiated the treaty first and then submitted it to the Senate for approval. But he can make executive agreements with foreign countries and send special representatives without consulting anybody. Strong presidents have always done these things. President Franklin Roosevelt sent a representative to the Vatican State, and I kept him there. And I tried to send an ambassador, but the man I appointed backed out on me and I didn't get it done. Turning again to the Constitution, the president's fourth job is his legislative responsibility. The Constitution says that he shall from time to time give Congress information on the State of the Union and recommend measures for their consideration. And of course, he must approve the laws before they can become effective, unless Congress can muster a two-thirds majority vote over his veto. The Constitution has written the president in as a vital and necessary part of the legislative process, and he's not supposed to stand back and be a yes man for the Congress. He must fight for his legislative program, and if he doesn't, he's a weak executive. Now, the fifth job of the president is quite a nice one, and one I like very much. The president is the head of his political party. You won't find this job mentioned in the Constitution. Political party leadership was the last thing the Constitution contemplated. The founding fathers did not intend the election of the president to be mixed up in the hurly-burly of party politics. But our two-party system, as it developed, changed all that. The Electoral College became a formality, and the president had come to be elected by the whole people. As a result, the president has emerged as the man who led his party to political victory and who was expected to set its policies for the future. And I want to say to you that a politician is a man who understands government. And when a man calls me a politician, I feel that I'm complimented. I have no desire to be one of these living so-called elder statesmen. Statesmen are not made till they've been dead 50 years, and I want to be a politician a long time for the benefit of this country if I can. Through his policies and actions, the president must try to convince the people that his party can run the national government better than the opposition. But at the same time, he must never forget that he is responsible to all the people in the nation, regardless of party, and he must always think of the welfare of the nation as a whole. The president and the vice president are the only officers elected from the United States at large. And as I've said time and again, the president is the only lobbyist in Washington who looks after the interests of about 150 or 60 millions of people. The other 15 or 20 million are able to hire people to go to Washington to present their claims to Congress on any subject they choose. Now, they call that lobbying. and it is a perfectly legitimate function and an exercise of the right of petition. But there are 150 or 60 million people who don't have any lobbyists and can't afford them. And it's the business of the president to find out what's good for the whole people, including the 20 or 30 million who have lobbyists and the 50 or 60 million who do not have, and to act as the principal lobbyist in the nation for the welfare and benefit of all the people. When a president does that, he's a good president. The president cannot carry out his legislative job and his political leadership without a lot of opposition. And if he doesn't have it, he's not doing any good. The Constitution makes the executive and the legislative separate and independent branches of the government. And as a result, there's a certain amount of conflict built into the Constitution. The separation of powers was not devised to promote efficiency in government. It was devised to prevent absolutism and dictatorship. So a certain degree of struggle between the president and the Congress is a natural and a good thing. It's the duty of the president to see that the constitutional powers of the presidency are not infringed. Some elements in Congress are always trying to legislate him out of office, to make themselves an English legislative government, which is not what the Constitution provides at all. And I think that Constitution is the greatest document of government that ever was written. And I've got an amateur's lecture on the subject, and I can talk to you about it from the lawmaking end of the Constitution, that the Constitution provides, and from the enforcement end, where the president has to work. And it's not exactly like what the lawyers tell you either. Now I come to the sixth job of the president. The president is the social head of this nation. And a great many of the stuffed shirt socialite people like this very, very much. They think it's the finest thing in the world to be able to meet dukes and princes and kings and queens and other dignitaries of foreign countries. Of course, when distinguished guests of that kind come to the United States, the president is their host, and he's always a courteous host. And it is a vital part of our international relationship. But you should see how the old dowagers around Washington pull strings and wires through the Congress and anybody else they think can talk to the president to get their daughters in so they might meet a duke or something and get a title. It doesn't work all the time, but sometimes they succeed. The president gives 5 or 6 state dinners each year at the White House and holds several large receptions. And if you think it's a lot of fun to stand in line for 2.5 hours and shake hands with 2,700 people whose names you can't even understand and whose names you don't give a hoot about either, you ought to try it sometime. It's not a pleasant job, but it has to be done. He holds diplomatic receptions, receptions for Congress, receptions for the Supreme Court, and various other receptions. And I want to say to you that the wife of a president has a tremendous burden. The last year we were in the White House, Mrs. Truman shook hands with some 50,000 people by count. I shook hands with 25,000 and dodged the rest. But she had to go ahead and do them all. Now, however, the social end of the president's office is a necessary job and a very important one. Now, I've enumerated for you six full-time jobs that one man has to fulfill. And there isn't any way in the world under the Constitution of the United States for him to get out of any one of them. He must do them. He must do them or they won't be done. And when they aren't done, it's just too bad for the country. There's only one way to do these six jobs, and that's to keep everlastingly at them and to give as much time to them as it is possible to squeeze out of every 24 hours. Now, there have been great presidents and hard-working presidents, and there have been presidents who didn't appreciate the responsibilities of the office. Washington was commander-in-chief of the colonial armies and won the independence of the 13 British colonies. He was the presiding officer of the Constitutional Convention of 1787. He was the first president and a great leader and established the government of the United States. He's one of the greatest of the great presidents. He had troubles with Congress. He was abused unmercifully by the press of the day, as all great presidents have been. In fact, for your information, Washington was about the most abused president ever was in the office. He never was in the White House. As I say, he was about the most abused president ever was in the office. And if he hadn't been abused, he wouldn't have done anything. Washington was followed by a New England reactionary, John Adams, who believed in special privilege class and who left the White House at midnight rather than ride with the next great president to the inauguration. But Adams and Jefferson afterward became friendly. Their correspondence is among the greatest of our historical documents, and everybody who has a chance ought to read those letters. They're published now in two little volumes, about that thick. And you get a great kick out of reading those letters. They give you an exact outline of the character of those two great men. Thomas Jefferson was a real Democrat, although just as much of an aristocrat as Adams. He bought Louisiana Territory from Napoleon for $15 million, explored the Northwest by Lewis and Clark, and laid the basis for our claim to Oregon Territory, which became 54-40 fight in Polk's time. He was bitterly attacked by the press, called a Jacobin, atheist, and a traitor to his country. And that, doesn't that sound natural? Only they use communist now instead of Jacobin. And they call him a traitor. They don't mind calling the president a traitor. I've been called one, but I don't think I was. He was followed by Madison and Monroe and John Quincy Adams. The country went into the hands of the special interests, and then came Andrew Jackson, another real people's president. He moved the money capital from Philadelphia to Washington and released the stranglehold of old man Biddle from the throats of the people. He too suffered a tremendous amount of abuse. He was followed by Van Buren, William Henry Harrison, and John Tyler. John Tyler's brother was my great-grandmother's father, and the family to which I belong never thought a great deal of old Tyler, but I've been reading about him here lately, and he really did some things I didn't think he had. Then came James K. Polk, and another strong and much abused president. He bought all the Southwest of Mexico, as I told you a while ago, but I don't think he made as good a bargain as Jefferson did. Polk was followed by a professional soldier, old Rough and Ready, Zachary Taylor, who died in office, and then came Fillmore and Franklin Pierce and James Buchanan, all easygoing, do-nothing presidents. And along came another great and strong president, Abraham Lincoln, who, by making the Constitution fit the emergency, saved the Union and really established the United States of America as a going concern and a great republic. He's among the greatest of the great presidents, too. Lincoln was followed by Andrew Johnson, who is another most abused president and who's been woefully misrepresented. There's a book out on him by Stryker that gives a good outline of Andrew Johnson. And he was a good man, but he wasn't a politician, and he was always in a fight with the people that he oughtn't been getting along with, and that's what caused him all his trouble. Johnson was followed by U.S. Grant, Rutherford Hayes, James A. Garfield, and Chester Arthur. And I could dwell on each one of these men, but that's not the objective nor my point. I'm very much interested in having all the youngsters here understand that my opinions of these presidents are my own. And I want to arouse your curiosity so you'll go and look at them yourselves and make up your own minds on it. That's why I'm here. And after Chester Arthur came another strong man, Grover Cleveland, who reestablished a two-party system and made the presidency a great office. He was followed by Benjamin Harrison and himself again. But I want to say to you, he was not the same Grover Cleveland in his second term as he was in his first. Then came William McKinley of Ohio. He was assassinated and followed by Theodore Roosevelt, who understood American history and the effect of the limelight on public personality. He understood certain reforms, undertook certain reforms and policies due much to the needling of William Jennings Bryan, and finally went so far as to be disowned by his own party. Best thing that ever happened was when he was disowned by his own party because that elected Woodrow Wilson. William Howard Taft was a kindly, easygoing man who was followed by one of the greatest of the great presidents, Woodrow Wilson. Wilson also was a great historian. He understood the greatness of the presidential office in its relation to the leadership and welfare of the country. Much against his will, he was forced into the First World War. I served under him as a captain of field artillery. He not only knew American history, but he knew world history and the history of government. He was familiar with the grand plan of King Henry IV of France, the greatest of the French kings. Wilson's effort to establish a League of Nations for peace in the world was what the great French king wanted to do. Both failed at the time, but not entirely. Wilson was followed by Warren G. Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover, and then came a Great Depression, and another of the greatest of the great presidents came along and saved the Republic, and that man was Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was forced into war just as Wilson was. He and Winston Churchill organized the free world and won that war. Then the United Nations was established, and the dreams of King Henry IV and Wilson came true. The great Roosevelt was followed by me, and the present occupant of the White House. I am anxious for all you young men and women to become curious about the history of your country and the world, and follow through by hard work to keep this republic the greatest republic in the history of the world. Great presidents have usually been followed by those not so great. But when the country needs leadership, it always comes forward. I may be talking right now to a man who may be leading this country sometime in this next generation. What I want you to do is to understand that you have the greatest government in the history of the world. And if it goes to pot, it'll be your fault, because of those of us who have come before you have tried our very best to pass it on to you in good shape. Now it's up to you. You now are the responsible people, and that's what I want to get over to you. And I want you to study these things, learn the history of your country, understand your government from precinct to president, and then you can be good citizens, and you won't be in a position to throw bricks at those who have to try to run the government. It's up to you to try to make it run better if you don't like the way it's run. Thank you very much.
President, thank you very much for that challenging, interesting, and instructive talk. Your presence here today has added great significance to this 100th commencement. So far as I have been able to determine, only once before in the 105-year history of this institution have we been honored by a president at a commencement program. 43 years ago, Theodore Roosevelt participated in the commencement of 1907. And we are indeed grateful to you for your willingness to come here today. Thank you very much. Now we'll proceed to the conferring of the degrees. By authority of the State of Michigan, vested in the Board of Trustees and delegated to me, I shall now confer degrees upon the candidates of the several colleges of Michigan State University as they are presented by the deans. In the current academic year, degrees have been or will be conferred upon a total of 4,265 individuals. Of that number, 3,139 are baccalaureate degrees, and 1,126 are advanced degrees. Incidentally, the total number for this year is greater than the total number conferred by this university from the date of its founding in 1855 through 1922, a span of 67 years. And you may be interested to learn that up until this year, Michigan State University had conferred a total of 61,164 degrees in its history, and that the degrees earned this year add nearly 7% to that total, bringing it to 65,429. The presentation of the candidates for degrees will be made in the order in which the several colleges were established. The candidates of the College of Agriculture, the first on this campus, and the first such in the United States, will be presented by Dean Thomas Cowden, the Dean of Agriculture. Dean Cowden.
For the candidates from the College of Agriculture for the degree of Master or Bachelor of Science, please rise. President Hanna, it is a pleasure to recommend that these candidates be awarded the degree of Bachelor of Science.
Michigan State University has granted the degree for which you have been recommended by the College of Agriculture, and to that degree I now admit you with all of the rights and privileges pertaining thereto.
Please, candidates for the degree of Master of Science in the College of Agriculture, please rise. President Hanna, on behalf of the College of Faculty of the College of Agriculture, it is a real honor to recommend that these candidates be awarded the degree of Master of Science.
The degrees for which you have been recommended have been granted by Michigan State University, and I now confer them upon you and admit you to all of the appropriate rights and privileges. And to all of those receiving degrees in the field of agriculture, may we extend congratulations upon becoming graduates of the oldest college of agriculture in the United States. The candidates of the College of Engineering, the second to come into being as this institution became the land-grant college for Michigan under the terms of the Morrill Act, will be presented by Dean John D. Ryder, the Dean of Engineering. Dean Ryder.
Will the candidates for the degree of Bachelor of Science in Engineering please rise? President Hanna, on behalf of the faculty of the College of Engineering, I wish to recommend these gentlemen for the conferring of the appropriate degrees.
Michigan State University has granted the degrees for which you have been recommended by the College of Engineering. And to those degrees, I now admit you with all of the rights and privileges pertaining to them.
Please be seated. Will the candidate for the degree of Master of Science in Engineering please rise? President Hanna, these gentlemen have satisfied the requirements of the faculty, and I'm pleased to recommend them to you for the degree of Master of Science.
The advanced degrees for which you have been recommended have been granted to you, and I now confer that degree upon you, admitting you to all of the rights and privileges to which it entitles you. May we congratulate you and all those who have received degrees in engineering, and wish for each of you every success and happiness in your chosen field of service. The third oldest college at Michigan State University is the College of Home Economics. The candidates for degrees will be presented by Dean Thelma E. Porter, the Dean of Home Economics. Dean Porter.
Will the candidates for the degree of Bachelor of Science in Home Economics please rise? President Hanna, these young women have satisfactorily met the requirements, and on behalf of the faculty of the College of Home Economics, it is my privilege to present them to you for the conferring of the appropriate degrees.
The degrees for which you have been recommended have been granted to you by Michigan State University, and to that degree I admit you with all of the rights and privileges pertaining thereto. Michigan State University has granted the degree for which you have been recommended, and I confer that degree upon you and admit you to all of the rights and privileges belonging thereto. And may all of those who have been awarded degrees in the College of Home Economics find success and satisfaction in their chosen fields of service. The candidates of the College of Veterinary Medicine will be presented by Dr. Willis W. Armistead, the Dean of Veterinary Medicine. Dean Armistead.
the candidates for the degree Bachelor of Science in Veterinary Medicine and in Medical Technology please rise. Mr. President, the candidates before you have completed the requirements and are recommended by the faculty for the award of this degree. I present them to you now so that the degree may be conferred.
The degrees for which you have been recommended have been granted by Michigan State University, and I now confer them upon you and admit you to all of the rights and privileges appertaining to them.
Will candidates for the degree Doctor of Veterinary Medicine please rise? Mr. President, these candidates have completed the requirements for the degree and are recommended by the faculty. I present them to you now so that the degree may be conferred.
The degree for which you have been recommended has been granted to you, and that degree I now confer upon you, admitting you to all of the rights and distinctions pertaining thereto.
Will candidates for the degree Master of Science in the College of Veterinary Medicine please rise? Mr. President, these candidates have completed the requirements and are recommended by the faculty for the degree Master of Science. I present them to you now so that the degree may be conferred.
The degree for which you are recommended has been granted to you, and I now confer that degree upon you and admit you to all of the privileges belonging to it. And may I congratulate all of those who have taken degrees in the College of Veterinary Medicine and wish you well in your important fields of service. The candidates of the College of Science and Arts, and as you all recognize, Science and Arts not only has its own majors, but is a major teaching division of Michigan State University offering service courses for all others in all other colleges. The candidates of the College of Science and Arts will be presented by Dean Lloyd C. Ferguson, the Dean of Science and Arts. Dean Ferguson.
Will the candidates for bachelor's degrees in the College of Science and Arts please rise? President Hanna, these candidates have completed the requirements for the Bachelor of Arts, or the Bachelor of Science, or the Bachelor of Music, the Bachelor of Fine Arts. On behalf of the faculty of the College of Science and Arts, it's a real pleasure to present them to you for conferral of the appropriate degree.
The degrees for which you have been recommended by the College of Science and Arts have been granted to you by Michigan State University. And those degrees I now confer upon you and admit you to all the rights and privileges belonging to them.
Will the candidates for the master's degrees in the College of Science and Arts please rise? President Hennett, these students have completed the requirements for the Master of Arts, or the Master of Science, or the Master of Music, or the Master of Arts for teachers. On behalf of the faculty of the College of Science and Arts, they are presented to you for conferral of the appropriate degree.
Michigan State University has granted the advanced degrees for which you have been recommended, and I confer them upon you now, admitting you to all of the rights and distinctions pertaining thereto. And it is my hope that all of those who have been awarded degrees in the College of Science and Arts will find contentment and personal satisfaction in their various fields of human service.
You may be seated.
The College of Business and Public Service is one of the largest at Michigan State University, and by reason of the wide range of its programs, one of the most important. In the unavoidable absence of Dean Alfred L. Seeley, the candidates will be presented by the Assistant Dean of that college, Dr. Leland E. Trawick. Dr. Trawick.
Will the candidates for the degrees of Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Science in the College of Business and Public Service please rise? President Hanna, these candidates have fulfilled the requirements for the degrees of Bachelor of Arts and Bachelor of Science in the College of Business and Public Service. The faculty of that college take pride in presenting them to you for the conferring of the appropriate degrees.
Michigan State University has granted to you the degrees for which you have been recommended, and those degrees I now confer upon you and admit you to all of the rights and privileges belonging to them.
Will the candidates for the degrees of Master of Arts, Master of Business Administration, Master of Science, Master of Social Work, and Master of Urban Planning in the College of Business and Public Service please rise? President Hanna, these candidates have fulfilled the requirements for the degrees of Master of Arts, Master of Business Administration, Master of Science, Master of Social Work, and Master of Urban Planning. The faculty of the College of Business and Public Service take great pride in presenting them to you for the awarding of the appropriate degrees.
The degrees for which you have been recommended have been granted to you, and those degrees I now confer upon you, admitting you to all the rights and distinctions pertaining to them. And may we extend congratulations to all of those who have taken degrees in the College of Business and Public Service and wish each of you well in your life's work. The training of teachers has always been an important function of this university, but the organization of those programs into a college known as a college of education is relatively recent. The mission of this college is one of great importance to our state and nation. We're very proud of the fact that this university is training as many teachers as any other university in the United States. The candidates will be presented by the Dean of Education, Dean Clifford E. Erickson. Dean Erickson.
Candidates for the bachelor's degrees from the College of Education, please rise. President Hanna, the faculty of the College of Education, is proud to present these candidates for the awarding of the appropriate degrees.
The degrees for which you have been recommended by the College of Education have been granted to you by Michigan State University, and I now confer those degrees upon you and admit you to all of the rights and privileges associated with them.
And these candidates to you for the conferring of the appropriate master's degrees.
The advanced degree for which you have been recommended has been granted to you, and I confer the degree upon you and admit you to all of the privileges and distinctions belonging thereto. And before you take your seats, I should like to point out that the dimensions of the service of Michigan State University in preparing teachers are not adequately represented only by those who earn degrees in the College of Education, because those in training to teach in the secondary schools receive the degrees in the colleges of their major. And I would appreciate it if all of those not in the College of Education who are graduating with teaching certificates would please rise. We wish all of you very well in your important field of service. Now, the College of Communication Arts is the college most recently established at Michigan State University, and the candidates will be presented by Dean Fred Siebert, who is participating in this ceremony today for the first time. Dean Siebert.
Will the candidates for bachelor's degrees from the College of Communication Arts please rise? Mr. President, These candidates are presented for the degree of Bachelor of Arts in the College of Communication Arts.
The degrees for which you have been recommended by your college have been granted to you, and those degrees I now confer upon you and admit you to all of the rights and privileges belonging thereto.
Will the one candidate for a master's degree from the college please stand? Mr. President, this young man, together with others listed in the official program, are presented for the degree of Master of Arts in the College of Communication Arts.
Michigan State University grants the degree for which you have been recommended, and I now confer that degree upon you, admitting you to the rights and distinctions belonging thereto. And I congratulate you, sir, and those that are receiving bachelor's degrees and having completed the work of the College of Communication Arts. Now we have among the graduating seniors a number of students who have been members of the Honors College. They are among the first of those selected to participate in this pioneering program for students of exceptional ability to complete the requirements for their degrees. They are identified in the program, so I do not intend to single them out for introduction, but I would like to have all of them stand as a group to accept your applause in recognition of the unique position in which they find themselves this afternoon, and for the scholarly attainments which qualified them for this honor. Will all of those graduating in the Honors College please stand? And let's give them a special hand. Now the candidates for the doctor's degree will be presented by the Dean of the School for Advanced Graduate Studies, Dr. Milton E. Melder, who is also Vice President of this university for research development. Vice President Melder.
Will the candidate for the doctoral degree please rise? President Hanna, at this commencement exercise, doctoral candidates are being presented from the College of Agriculture, Business and Public Service, Communication Arts, Education, Engineering, the College of Science and Arts, and the College of Veterinary Medicine. The work of each doctoral candidate has been performed under the direction and guidance of a major professor and guidance committee in the major department. On behalf of the faculty, department heads, and the dean, who have certified the fulfillment of all the requirements, it is my honor to present them to you for the awarding of the doctoral degree.
Ladies and gentlemen, the doctor's degrees for which you have been recommended have been granted to you by Michigan State University. And I now confer those degrees upon you and admit you to all of the high honors, rights, and distinctions pertaining to them, and congratulate you upon your scholarly achievements. Please come to the platform individually as your names are called by Dean Melder to receive appropriate tokens of your accomplishments.
Abdul Salam Abbas.
Congratulations, Dr. Abbas.
Robert John Ackerman.
Congratulations, Dr. Ackerman.
David Daniel Anderson.
Congratulations, Dr. Anderson.
Let's Castro Assumption.
Congratulations, Dr. Assumption.
Nguyen Thu Phan.
Congratulations, Dr. Bond.
Robert Jackson Bevins.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Alan Ross Bird.
Congratulations, Dr. Bird.
Ronald Edward Loss.
Congratulations, Dr. Loss.
Clyde Leon Burton.
Congratulations, Dr. Burton.
Bruce Charles Carlton.
Congratulations, Dr. Carlton.
Dirishki Dar Chatterjee.
Congratulations, Dr. Chatterjee.
Donald Arthur Davis.
Congratulations, Dr. Davis.
Sataya Deva Dubey.
Congratulations, Dr. Dubey.
Andrew J. DeBreen.
Congratulations, Dr. DeBreen.
Lester Lee Eberhardt.
Congratulations, Dr. Eberhardt.
John Nelson Ferris.
Congratulations, Dr. Ferris.
William Lloyd Finney.
Congratulations, Dr. Finney.
Robert Bastian Foy.
Congratulations, Dr. Foy.
John B. Yenis.
Congratulations, Dr. Dennis.
Herbert Randall Hanks.
Congratulations, Dr. Hanks.
Stanley Oliver Inkenberry.
Congratulations, Dr. Eichberg.
Russell G. Mauby.
Congratulations, Dr. Mauby.
Daniel Roy McLaughlin.
Congratulations, Dr. McLaughlin.
Roy Malcolm Miller.
Congratulations, Dr. Miller.
Richard Joy George Pfister.
Congratulations, Dr. Pfister.
Thank you.
Josette Marjorie Portigo.
Congratulations, Dr. Portigo.
Hector Cui Aruelo.
Congratulations, Dr. Aruelo.
Tama Venkata Tamaswara Rao.
Congratulations, Dr. Rao.
Charles Erston Rice.
Congratulations, Dr. Rice.
Howard Alex Rosenkrantz.
Congratulations, Dr. Rosenkrantz.
Mary Lou Rosenkrantz.
Congratulations, Dr. Rosenkrantz.
Charles Walter Rutledge.
Congratulations, Dr. Rutledge.
K. N. Satiapo.
Congratulations, Dr. Satiapo.
Thomas Clinton Seward.
Congratulations, Dr. Seward.
Horace John Shaw.
Congratulations, Dr. Shaw.
Indra Pal Singh.
Congratulations, Dr. Singh.
Max Douglas Stewart.
Congratulations, Dr. Stewart.
Leslie Warren Tobin.
Congratulations, Dr. Tobin.
Leslie Graham Young.
Congratulations, Dr. Young.
Martin Slutowski.
Congratulations, Dr. Slutowski.
Ronald James Baird.
Congratulations, Dr. Baird.
Alton Walter Cole.
Congratulations, Dr. Cole.
Ornsby L. Harris.
Congratulations, Dr. Harris.
Francis Joseph Hennessy.
Congratulations, Dr. Hennessy.
Mildred Emily Summers.
Congratulations, Dr. Summers.
Warren Stanley Soyne.
Congratulations, Dr. Soyne.
Merton James Turk.
Congratulations, Dr. Turk.
Leonard B. Voorhees.
Congratulations, Dr. Voorhees.
Peter M. Wickman.
Congratulations. I now call upon Star Hammond Kiesler of the Class of 41, the Director of Alumni Relations, to present those alumni who have been nominated for special recognition because of their distinguished achievements. Mr. Kiesler.